If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
My friends, the great experiment.
The greatest trick.
Hidden trick.
Would you look at that?
The greatest trick.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.
Welcome to Greatest Trek. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation, and it's pilot season. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. Pilot season, the 10-week sprint from sort of when we ran out of other ideas to when Discovery starts. And we have a date now.
Oh, yeah. What's that date?
It's like the week after the Max Fun Drive, amazingly.
Oh, that's good timing.
I know. Yeah. If it had been the week of the Max Fun Drive, we might actually stand to have a successful year. But no.
I think we'll have a great year, like any other year.
I hope so. I think people are liking pilot season. I feel like this has been, I mean, it's been really fun for us, but I also, it's really nice to go on to my marginal at best social media website of choice and see all the nice comments about it.
The only source material as inexhaustible as Star Trek are the Miriam science fiction show pilots that exist.
It's really true.
Throughout television history.
Yeah.
So I think this is a great concept by you because I think we could have done this for longer even. I think we could have waited out Star Trek is what I'm saying.
Right. I think they said April, but they hadn't specified a date in April for Disco coming back. So, I mean, it could have gone 3 more weeks, but I think we could have gone 10 more weeks if we needed to. This should be its own fucking show, man.
Yeah. I mean, who's going to blink first? Star Trek did.
Greatest Trek has the upper hand now.
Yeah, exactly.
This also a Gene Roddenberry series that we're going to be talking about today.
Is this 3 in a row of old Gene shows?
Is it?
I don't know. It feels like we're on kind of a run.
Well, no, because we did Farscape.
Uh-huh.
Stargate.
Farscape only seemed like a Gene show.
Farscape seemed like Gene and Jim Henson had a baby. Stargate SG-1, not a Gene show. Earth Final Conflict, Gene show. Really a Majel show, and this is also more a Majel show than a Gene show, right?
Do you think all of these Gene shows are the result of an old guy just not putting a lock on his file cabinet before dying?
Yeah.
Or whatever? Like, do you think he ever really wanted to make these?
I don't know. They do have the, like, oh, we found some, like, papers with some sketched out ideas on his desk, and you know, like, the brand Gene Roddenberry _S before the title of any show is gonna get some butts and some seats because people fucking love that guy's shit.
It's true. Yeah I wonder if there are any more in reserve. Like, are we down to the bottom of the file cabinet here?
That is a question I don't know the answer to. I wonder, like, is it going to be like, you know, Tupac continuing to release records for years?
the first recorded instance of Gene Roddenberry being compared to Tupac Shakur just occurred.
Mark it down.
If you're betting, go ahead and cash those tickets.
But also, this has some other Star Trek pedigree under the hood. Of course, Robert Hewitt Wolf was the showrunner on this guy. I mean, I think for like a season and a half, and then they shit canned Robert Hewitt Wolf. And it's very interesting because I think that, like,
what do you have to do to be fired from this show? I think you're about to tell me. I hope it's not scandalous.
No, it didn't seem that way. I didn't do a ton of research into this, but so two things I read that feel like they must be related to me are Robert Hewitt Wolf is best known to Star Trek fans for his work on DS9. Yeah. And the reason he got fired was that the suits wanted to take the show in a much more episodic direction. And at the beginning, it was lots of arcs and lots of threads that they were, you know, building big stories on. And, you know, Deep Space Nine is sort of famous for changing television, like making television become more serialized and more about following stories from week to week. And I think it's so interesting that at some point there was somebody in a boardroom that was like, this Andromeda series has got to start bucking the trend of other television shows and getting more episodic. It's just got to be about, you know, our main character getting into a new disconnected adventure week to week.
RHW was a veteran of those episodic wars.
Yeah.
Imagine how crazy that had to feel.
Yeah.
hey guys, here's an idea. Maybe instead of shit canning me and going in this direction, how about you make a main title sequence that just tells everyone about the show and the characters and what they're doing? I think this is a great idea. That way, a new viewer is going to know exactly what's up, no matter what episode we're in.
Let's do the numbers now, because I think this is our eighth pilot season episode. Sequest had a title sequence that explained it. Babylon 5 did. Space Precinct did. Sliders did.
Yeah.
Did Earth Final Conflict have one? It did.
It did, yeah.
Stargate SG-1?
I don't think it did.
That, I think, is the one outlier in the the title sequence explains what the show you're watching is.
But it was also based on a pre-existing piece of media, so maybe there's an understanding there that, like, you kind of know what this is, don't you?
Yeah. You don't just show somebody a new show without explaining what the show is to them.
That's the Wayne Grow of title sequences. Like, you know what this is. That's the Grim Reaper of title sequences.
Oh, God. I was going to go in it's the Dan Savage dirty talk direction with it, but which is not what Wayne Grow was doing. He was like, I'm going to murder you.
Yeah.
I'm murdering you. I just murdered you.
You want some pie?
So after Stargate, we had what?
Farscape, which definitely had one.
Farscape, yeah. Yeah. Wow.
And now here we are at Andromeda, and we got one again.
Interesting other thread of DNA in here. We're just throwing the DNA all over our Marin right now.
There's just ropes of DNA just shooting all over the place.
Alan Croker, familiar as a director of Star Trek over the decades, but one piece of trivia about him I did not realize until just today is that he was the director of the finales of Deep Space Nine and of Voyager and Enterprise.
Wow.
Wow.
He gaveled all of those series.
Wow.
Isn't that wild? No one's ever going to do that again.
That is the hat trick of all hat tricks, man.
Yeah. Maybe that's what he was going for here, a one and done. Like, I'm gonna do the pilot, see if I can wrap this one up early.
Yeah, interesting. Because, like, for a director, the pilot is a very lucrative job to get. If the show goes to series, which this one, like, this show had a 5-season run, and the director of the pilot gets paid for every single episode because they get paid for, like, creating the look and the production style of the show. And, I mean, it's awesome to gavel a bunch of series, but money-wise, it's much better to pilot.
Yeah, it's better to do the first one.
Yeah, so that is an interesting little statistic. Do you want to get into Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, Adam?
Speaking of shows that have a very specific look right off the bat, let's do.
It's the pilot, Adam. It's season one, episode one, Under the Night.
You know the greatest danger facing us is an irrational fear of the unknown.
It's the captain. No, not bad people, but I'm not doing any cartwheels.
Any good science fiction show should do the lingering exterior shot of the hero ship, right? And the Andromeda has some pretty sleek lines.
It does. It's a little veiny almost. Like, I would say that
it's a little vascular.
It's a little, yeah, it was like a little upsettingly vascular. Like,
and why all the throbbing?
Yeah. You know, why does it, they don't fly in a straight line. They seem to fly back and forth, back and forth.
Along a curve, really.
What's the Seth MacFarlane sci-fi show? I feel like this ship looks a lot like the ship in the Orville.
The Orville, you're right.
But yeah, we start with this quote about the Commonwealth's high guard, which this is set like in the very distant future, I guess. Common year, so who knows? CY11942. So this isn't like Dune where it's the year 10,000 and it's like the same, you know, like the same reckoning as we currently use.
I mean, the thing about, you know, putting a quote up on screen and sort of a nonsensical date is it ascribes a significance to the thing, right?
Yeah. And that really did remind me of Dune, like, you know, or, you know, there's a million sci-fi novels where at the beginning of a chapter, there's a little quote from a book that is, you know, in world, you know, it's like, oh, this was like a history of this time written by some historian, like modeled on a Roman novel or something.
Am I remembering correctly? Did Jurassic Park also kind of do that at the beginning of chapters?
Oh, I don't think it did.
I feel like there was like science report stuff kicking off all the chapters. That was a long time ago. That was a middle school read.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the book Jurassic Park? Oh, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I haven't thought about that book since I read it before the movie came out.
Yeah. Captain Kevin Sorbo is one of the first characters we meet, and he really goes down a ladder fast.
He really does. It sort of seems like the ship is in trouble at the beginning of this because they're beating to quarters, and turns out this is just a drilling on, you know, getting to battle stations.
They've got a real Rob Schneider type as the XO screaming out orders.
The Tomster making copies. Mr. Tom. Tommy.
Too slow.
Too loud.
I would presume that you would style yourself as like the good captain.
Right.
The kind captain. You want an XO like this to do your screaming for you, right?
You do. You want a Gaheris Rade. raw dogging your crew.
Oh yeah, you know that's his nickname behind his back.
Yeah, I didn't notice the like bony spikes on his arms initially. Like, I thought that was just a detail on the uniform. You know,
it was unclear to me whether that was bone or not. I thought it was uniform.
That's bone.
Yeah, the drill doesn't go great. Also, like, we are just like in media bad sci-fi lighting. I think that the way this ship looks, and it's so sad in the script because so much is made about how like beautiful and what a masterpiece it is in the dialogue later, but it is just like flat lighting on a hard, inexpensively built set, which does not kind of bear up under the vibe that they're trying to go for.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this. Like, let's drill down into the suggestion of beauty about this ship, because yeah, they talk about it all the time. There is kind of an undercurrent of sex in this entire thing.
Absolutely.
From the leather uniforms to the ship being embodied by a attractive hologram woman.
An attractive hologram in a wonder bra. Like,
it made me wonder if Captain Kevin Sorbo got to select like who his Siri was going to be.
Right.
And that's who this was as captain, because this is the first time I've ever seen a science fiction show where I looked at the ship and it moved. You know?
Yeah.
That's what they want to have happen.
It's interesting because, like, coming from one of the main writers of Deep Space Nine, this is a very interesting difference in vibe. It's like horny,
yeah,
but it's also like they're doing bits a lot. You know, like, yeah, the first thing that happens is like the ship kind of razzing him for being a little bit reckless, mm-hmm, with his gravity reversal device on his belt, jumping down the ladder. And then we've got, like, you know, like the battle drill doesn't go well, and we're kind of like joking around about how much we suck and stuff like that.
The computer has opinions. It's not just quoting the Miriam rules that you've broken by sliding down the ladder too fast. Like, it's kind of razzing you.
Yeah. And the captain is razzing right back. Like, there's some sass to the way he interacts. And it kind of, I don't know, it sort of reminded me of the thing we read about MacGyver, like, agreeing to go on Stargate SG-1 if he could play the character a little bit more comedically, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, I think Kevin Sorbo was, like, finishing the Hercules series when he was attached to Star in this show. So I wonder if he had similar stipulations. Like, I want it to be, like, funny.
I want to be the commanding officer of a shilf. You flirt enough with the ship, Ben,
yeah,
something's bound to happen.
I know.
Mistakes are going to get made.
We learn a little bit more about Commander Rahade. Rahade?
Big Rahade?
Yeah. He is a Nietzschean who are, from context clues through the episode, sort of on the model of Khan Noonien Singh, like augmented, mm-hmm, genetically engineered humans, but better than humans. And I guess one of the things that they engineered for themselves is like Batman glove bones that stick out of their arms and can be used in fights.
It's such a, like, if you're doing cafeteria power-ups to your science fiction character, I don't know, you play way more role-playing games than I do. Like, I just feel like this one's kind of lame.
It's like,
like, it's better than nothing. I'll definitely take it, but like,
I am the Waffler. With my griddle of justice, I bash the enemy in the head, or I burn them like so.
If you were, like, putting together a team of superheroes, this would be like, this guy would be on the B squad, you know? He's like the Marvel Avenger that is really good at shooting bow and arrows.
Right.
So yeah, he's bit of a pessimist, and, you know, like, they have a little kind of debate that shows that this guy has a very strong adherence to a very specific worldview that is informed by Nietzsche. And as they're having this conversation, we hear from the bridge that there is a distress signal coming in. We got to get up there. Got to see this bridge, baby.
Many great science fiction stories start exactly like this.
Yeah. I mean, you could just smell Gene Roddenberry's fingerprints all over this. Why are they so smelly?
Yes, we must smell Gene Roddenberry's fingers to know what he's been up to here.
So, interesting twist on the bridge design. The big chair in the middle of the bridge is not the captain's. It is a little insect lady. And the captain stands off to the side at a standing desk with his juggy Siri character.
Doesn't that make sense? If you're starting from a clean sheet Starship bridge design?
Yeah.
Yeah, you put the pilot in the middle.
Forget everything you know about bridge design.
I might put more seatbelts on the pilot or something. They really flop around at that station later.
Yeah. We get the distress signal. It is like a classic Star Trek distress signal. We're an unarmed ship.
Mm-hmm. It's real Kobayashi Maru, right?
Yeah, there's this rogue black hole coming into the Hephaestus system. We're going to need some help. And don't worry about like the literary symbolism of calling the system Hephaestus at all.
Mm-mm.
And they, like, you know, do some math. There's 500 million sentients in this system. Which I really liked that as an update of the terminology. Nobody gets called a racist for calling them humanoids, you know?
If you could only hear yourselves.
Get that right. Did it throw you off the scent a little bit? Like all this description of what was on the other side of their transit. They go through the slipstream and that pilot really gets rocked, maybe worse than anyone for some reason.
It is a violent experience to go to warp in this series. Like, I mean, it doesn't seem like Kevin Sorbo's any better. Like he's got to hold on for dear life to his little control station. He doesn't even have a seatbelt.
Did it dawn on you so late that this was a trap? Because like they emerge on the other side and there are so many ships. And I was like, why are there so many ships over there? But right on the heels of how populated this area of space was, I kind of paid it no mind. I was like, oh, that's just how it is over there. It's just trafficy.
Yeah, they said that there was 500 million people over there. So that must be those people and all their stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
The trapness definitely wasn't clear to me. And I think that one of the real strengths of this pilot is how much in media race we feel like we are. Like we are just in this world and they aren't stopping and explaining a ton of it to us in a way that would slow it down or make it less interesting. But also like many of the things about this world, I'm like, wait, huh?
We get our title sequence here after it's revealed that it is a trap on the other side of their transit. And we get kind of a middle version of the theme that explains it all and the theme that explains nothing. Like the theme tells us that the Commonwealth as a society is under attack. And the Andromeda is the name of the ship. It's the last best hope for something.
Yeah.
On the starship Andromeda, hope lives again.
Here are your guys. Here are your tough guys fighting on their side.
I mean, I appreciated that it didn't just give the entire rest of the pilot away the way it did in Earth Final Conflict. But yeah, it does telegraph some of what's about to happen.
Hey, it's me, Captain Dylan Hunt. You might be wondering why I have such a sexy spaceship. Shh. Or why I'm wearing all this leather. You don't need to know that either.
Do you think that this show, I mean, obviously has a lot of CGI, so it's like a very highly computerized show. Do you think it was written on a computer, and therefore do you think it was pretty easy to find and replace the first name Mike for the main character when, you know, and they're about to start shooting and they're like, we can't do it.
I was trying to puzzle out that joke for this episode for so long. I spent more time thinking about that than I did watching the episode.
Darwin thought a lot about it too.
Nice C-word joke, Ben. You did it. You won.
I didn't even get anywhere near it.
Yeah.
They get to their battle stations in record time, under 3 minutes, which is what they've been drilling on. And it's just not great odds. This is a very well-equipped ship, but they're up against 10,000 ships.
Yeah, they're outnumbered by that many. I love the XO here. The screaming XO does not scream his suggestion on the bridge. Instead, he's like, you know, we could just drop that giant bomb that we have and just destroy the entire system. This is not an idea that Captain Kevin Sorbo really considers at this point. But it does make me think about it at the end of the episode.
Yeah, and it
like it has a bomb on board.
It's such a interesting thing in retrospect about this episode. It makes just you bringing it up makes me think of how much this episode feels like it is specifically about World War II.
Mm.
Like, are we going to unleash a cataclysmic explosion to forestall this other like worse thing or whatever. But like, you know, it's unknowable and Captain Kevin Sorbo refuses to go nuclear in this conflict. But the other side of that is the Nietzschean first officer is like, well, I and all of the other Nietzscheans aboard should be rounded up and taken away from vital systems. And that also feels super World War II, right?
You know what? At least until you can just figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Maybe you should round us up.
And it's very interesting and fucked up. I guess it like it sort of makes sense if their like entire philosophy is Nietzsche, like the most pragmatic way of consolidating power at all times is their true north. So that would be something that he would advocate for.
It's interesting when the Exo reveals himself to be a saboteur and a bad guy, why he would want to put himself in position, like, why would he voluntarily take himself off the bridge?
Yeah.
If his main strategy was to take over the ship.
Right, because then he just has to, like, fight his way back to the bridge.
Yeah. Maybe he's just a master storyteller when it comes to his own legend.
Well, those two security guys, he really wanted to get the bones up in their guts, as it were.
One aspect to this show that I really, really respect is how much sparks and debris they're willing to use during a battle sequence. Like, there are folks with jerk cables attached to them in chairs in front of panels exploding, and they're being ripped up and away from those panels as they shower sparks and debris everywhere.
Yeah.
Really great stuff, I thought. And they know it's great too, because like they've set up multiple cameras to capture it.
Yeah.
In many different speeds. I think that's fun.
RSVP Lieutenant Thompson, he was one of the guys at Starboard Battle Station 5 that we met during the drill earlier.
This one hurts.
Yeah, and his blue companion who is doing a silly alien voice is very sad about it.
I'm so sad that you're dead, Thompson. You're my best friend.
Blue alien voiced by Ralph the dog.
I loved singing songs over my out-of-tune beer.
So it is very quick that this battle breaks against the Andromeda Ascendants and its crew, and Captain Kevin Sorbo is like, okay, this ship is going to get destroyed. Like, I got to save my crew and get the fuck out of here and warn the rest of my Commonwealth. So he orders everybody to abandon ship, and he is going to solo pull like the maneuver from Star Trek IV, which is slingshot the ship around this rogue black hole. And like the pilot, Lieutenant Refractions of Dawn, is like, you're going to need a hell of a pilot to go along with you. And it like, it's one of those like moments where it's like, if this was the end of a movie and like, you know, they'd had a fitful relationship up until now, but it's like, oh, like she's super down with him now. Like they finally made it and they trust each other. It would have been a stand up and clap moment. But
yeah,
instead it's like, I don't know who that is. And it's sort of meaningless. But she stays with him. So everybody's like running for the escape pods.
How do I say this in a way that isn't like the bad kind of insulting? Refractions of Dawn, I think, could make it a lot easier within the command structure during a time of war or emergency to maybe like go by Dawn.
Mm.
You know, to like expedite the order giving and receiving in a moment like this.
Just like cut down the number of syllables that everyone has to say before, you know, turn left or whatever.
I'm not trying to erase her identity or anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to like make things go.
Sure. So our Nietzschean commander double crosses and arm spikes the security dudes who are taking him into custody.
This is why you have those spikes aimed that exact way.
Yeah.
Like, it's a power up that's built for a scene like this.
Yeah. On the one hand, I was, you know, alarmed that he was double crossing. On the other hand, those security guys were coded as like very evil in a way that like, I wonder if this show does anything to, you know, interrogate whether the Commonwealth was actually a force for good.
Tell me about that. That part didn't hit me.
We don't know anything about the Commonwealth based on this episode, or like, I mean, like, I think that like the Nietzscheans feel like bad guys and the fact that they...
Because of all the killing, for instance.
Because they're doing all this killing and destroying a civilization because they disagree with it. I'm willing to sign off on that.
I think that's weird, Ben. Like, I'm actually on the side of those trying to bring them to justice.
I'm just saying that the styling of those security guys made me think maybe the Commonwealth isn't the paragon of good that Kevin Sorbo believes it to be.
I think you're just confused by the leather. And it is very confusing. Leather. There's too much leather. It's squeaking. Imagine how loud that hallway was when that guy was being perp walked down there.
Well, but then they like evacuate all the atmosphere in the rest of the ship.
Yeah.
In space, no one can hear your leather squeak.
I love the unspoken detail of the Exo putting his rebreather straw over his lips. That was neat.
That was cool. So he seems to be able to survive in vacuum, which is another superpower. Then he heads back toward the bridge and everybody else like is getting out in escape pods and the ship is heading into the black hole and Roddy shoots the AI on like a TV screen on his way up to the bridge in a way that's like, that seems like it would just be a panel that doesn't actually, like, she's going to be fine, right? Like, she's not in there.
It kind of unnecessarily draws her attention to what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way, I thought. But maybe it's like a security camera, like where you see her and disable her would mean like maybe that actually does help his cause. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a big confrontation in the bridge where, you know, he kills Refractions of Dawn and then he's shooting at Kevin Sorbo and kind of like villain ranting about why the Nietzscheans are doing what they are doing. And it has to do with the Magog, who are a species that the Commonwealth recently signed a treaty with. And the Magog sound bad. They sound like they do horrible shit. They like eat sentience. They do a lot of rape and overall sound like real unsavory characters.
You get his gripe, right? Yeah. Like you make peace and compromise with folks like that. That's no good.
Right. It was an uneasy alliance that the Commonwealth had with the Nietzscheans to begin with, but this kind of took everything over the edge. And they get in a big fist fight. And as they're fighting, like, time is starting to get all fucked up on the ship.
Ben, if you've got to make your 46 minutes here, don't you love a scene like this? Yeah. Like you are going to nail your time exactly when you have time dilations involved in a fight scene.
Well, yes, but I thought that the combat stuff in this scene was so great at the beginning. Like it was like a very interesting dynamic battle that starts where they're shooting at each other, but then it's like, it's a melee fight after a certain point. And, you know, Kevin Sorbo had a ton of reps doing this kind of, you know, like interesting screen action like this going into this. So like, it's just like this is so much better than like Riker, you know, getting in a fight with somebody in season one of TNG or whatever.
Yeah, you get a roundhouse kick into a glass table in that season.
Yeah.
And then this one is like a fully developed, this is like a practically a martial arts competition amount of moves here.
Yeah, but then because of this time dilation plot device, everything slows down and it like it just took the wind out of the fight for me. And I was like, like that fight was so cool. And like by the time Kevin Sorbo finally shoots and kills this dude, it was just like, I don't know. I don't really care.
I mean, we're taking people off the board left and right. RSVP Garrus Rade.
Yeah. And Kevin Sorbo and the Starship Andromeda's AI are like the only people left aboard. And like time stops by way of a freeze frame.
It looks like the very beginning of the Warner Brothers logo, you know, when it's super close up on the logo before it pulls back right. for the reveal.
Right. Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, that kind of like gold tint that goes on everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Elsewhere, we arrive at a rusty space tug and meet its captain, Becca Valentine. On the bridge is also kind of a wolf pimp. And like a human, like a 20-year-old human guy with a neck rash. And Wolf Pimp makes it pretty clear that he's paying for this trip.
Mm-hmm.
And he's pretty impatient about how fast this mission's going.
I'm worried about Wolf Pimp. That Gin Blossom makes me think that he's not taking good care of himself. You know, he's not controlling his party enough.
Yep.
So Wolf Pimp is the client, and Becca Valentine and her scrappy crew are salvagers who are here in the Hephaestus system looking for something. And what they are looking for just so happens to be the Andromeda Ascendant.
Which appears on their screen. They found it right next to the space butthole.
Right there.
Right where they left it.
The ship, we learn, is called the Maru. I looked it up. It's not the Kobayashi Maru. It is the Eureka Maru.
I see.
Wolf Pimp is like so excited about this because the Andromeda was the pride of the system's commonwealth, and he's got a buyer lined up, and just, oh man, so exciting.
We meet the rest of the crew of this space tug. We get a purple cat lady named Trance Gemini. We got a Rev Bem, which is like kind of a furry Batman looking guy, and the rash guy's name is Seamus.
There's a lot of Batman references between the Nietzschean's wrist weaponry and this man looking like a bat.
Sure seems like it. Yeah. They seem to be like, it's not just Wolf Pimp that's excited to have found this salvage. The idea of everyone getting paid from it is very exciting to the rest of the crew.
Yeah, there's a whole like, what are you gonna do when your lotto ticket hits conversation that they're having, and finding this ship seems to be a huge come up for these people. So they're talking about, you know, all the fun that they're going to get into with all their money. The Batman is mostly focused on spending his winnings on absolution. He plans to build a hospital on a planet called Kingfisher to apologize for whatever horrible shit his people did to the people of Kingfisher.
I did not like this moment for his character. This felt like pilot compression into character backstory. Because, like, to me, it's more interesting if everyone goes around going like, yeah, strippers and blow. Woo! like I'm blowing it, baby.
Yeah.
And then, like, if they landed on him and he's like, I don't much want to talk about that.
Right.
Like, that's interesting. But that he just says the quiet part out loud about, like, I'm a terrible person who comes from terrible people and I want to make it right with the money. Like, reveal that later, and that's more interesting to me. But that feels like the pilot forces them to do this.
I'm going to argue a little bit the other side. I thought it was so interesting that he seemed to be very focused on repentance, but had zero actual shame about it. He's like, I did all this bad stuff, so I need to pay my debts.
As if it is a transaction?
Yeah, he doesn't really seem to feel that bad about the terrible stuff.
That's really interesting.
In this way that is like very alien, I think, specifically.
Like, I put my tithing money in, I'm good for another week.
Right, yeah. He's basically getting alien plenary indulgences with his Andromeda payout. Yeah. So they're like, okay, we're going to go in and get this ship, but we need to lighten up our load so that we have enough thruster capacity to pull us and it. And that means we're dropping our payload. And I thought the design of the ship was really interesting. It sort of feels like it's a little bit inspired by the Nostromo in Alien, where there's like a big part of it that is like just cargo, and then there's a part underneath it that's just the ship, and they can be separated.
Well, and even more than that, what made the Destromo interesting to me was its verticality. Like, so many science fiction ships are wider than they are tall.
Size 54 waist, 10-inch legs, fucking junk.
And this one is tall in that Nostromo kind of way.
Yeah, and it's also, like, you know, we can maybe talk about this more if we want to, but one thing that I thought was so good about this set design versus the set design of the Andromeda is... obviously, this is like a lower budget show than any Star Trek show that we've ever watched. But the fact that this ship feels super different and almost like it's from a different franchise.
Yeah.
I feel like really does a great job of showing what a changed galaxy the Andromeda has found itself in. Like, when they're looking out their window at the Andromeda, like, the Andromeda just looks like totally different intellectual property, you know?
I like that a lot.
Everything is rusty and like half broken on their ship.
In the way that a Model T looks unusual right next to a curvy looking Mercedes Benz,
totally,
you know?
Totally.
This is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Wolf Pimp is like, whoa, before we, you know, unbuckle from the cargo area, let me run up there. And he runs up and there's a bunch of coffins. Unfortunately, no like hand wiping frost away from the glass moment here. Because I don't think that they wanted to reveal exactly what they are, but it's like very hard, having watched any sci-fi at all, not to think, oh, these are stasis pods and there's people in them.
Hey, Captain Becca Valentine, what are you doing? Why didn't you check Wolf Pimp's cargo?
Check the cargo before you let Wolf Pimp just come. I mean, look at this guy. He does not look trustworthy. How many chains does one guy need?
Don't worry. We'll retrieve your cargo when we get back.
No, wait. I have to make some preparations in the pod before we detach it.
If Captain Becca Valentine is doing, like, the Uber mission that this appears to be, you don't just let Wolf Pimp get in your back seat carrying whatever. You're really right about the configuration of these coffins, though. Like, only one thing is inside. That's what kind of makes the surprise reveal at the end so unsurprising.
Not a surprise.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess a Nietzschean arm reaches up, right? Like,
and that may be the part that is a surprise. Like, if this is hundreds of years later, like, huh, okay.
Yeah.
I wonder what their deal is.
So those guys are still running around. The ship detaches and we go down, and it's a big old sequence about like harpooning the Andromeda and then the cables breaking. And it's like, need to get one big boost of power. And Seamus Harper manages to figure that out. But it like, I did feel like there was a lot of, like, the engine might explode blue balls at the end of this sequence, because he's like, oh, shit, like, reactor 3 is going critical, and we cut up to the bridge, and Becca Valentine's like, that fucking idiot put protons in the matter stream or something like that. But then, like, there's no more mention of the fact that their ship almost exploded after that.
Is there something about Rashy Seamus that, like, there's a, the thing about the rash, is that supposed to tell you about how little he cares for himself, or maybe how little he cares about the rest of the crew that would make a decision like this seem appropriate for a person like him? Or is the rash unrelated to anything related to the story? I kept thinking about the rash, and I'm like, why am I thinking about this? But the camera finds it. He's always scratching it. Like,
yeah.
What is this?
No, it's disgusting back there.
Thank you.
It's a rash. It's like a red rash on one side of his neck, but there's like a black bit in the middle of it that kind of looks like a scar. And then he's got that clip show device on the other side of his neck.
Yeah, he's sort of a half Frankenstein's monster.
Did the rash start because one of his clip show devices came off and like that was like keeping it in check, or...
Having a half clip show device on has got to be like being on psychedelics, right? That's got to be a real trip.
They get the Andromeda up into normal space, and time unfreezes on board the Andromeda. And pretty quickly, Andromeda AI is reporting to Captain Sorbo, like, I'm scanning around and all of the escape pods and bad guys that we were just fighting are gone. Something fucked up happened with the time dilation when we went too close to the black hole. And she drops it on him like a ton of bricks. We've been frozen in time for 300 years.
I love that, like, the sophistication that the Andromeda AI has had up until now has seemed like fun and interesting. Up until the point where she has to break some bad news, then it's like, oh, this AI should really be better at this. At like what you need to do and how you need to act in a moment like this.
Yeah. I don't know about you. I watched this pilot on YouTube, and there's that feature where like on the timeline, there's a little waveform that shows you where people especially watched this episode. And all of those spikes were on, like, action sequences, except for this moment. The moment where Kevin Sorbo reacts to learning that, like, his family are dead. Everyone he knows is dead. Everything he's ever, you know, been connected to has gone into history.
I'm sorry, Dylan. Everyone we know, our entire world, is gone.
Michael Bay shot around Kevin Sorbo as he stands up fully erect.
Disappointed! I do think he did a pretty good job with this moment. Like, I don't know how an actor can really prepare for this. Like, I think he probably Brando'd here.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I really like about it is how, like, he is processing this, and then we cut back over to the Maru, and they're, like, suiting up to get their salvage. But then the next time you see Kevin Sorbo, he's still processing it. It's not, like, a scene for him to be, like, 300 years into the future, no! And then, and then, like, he's, like, finished his feelings about that.
They cut back to him, and it's still, oh! Real question, as seriously as possible, I want you to consider this. It's a would you rather question.
Okay.
Would you rather be reanimated from, let's just call it a coma or whatever, like the singularity of a black hole? Would you rather be reanimated, let's say like 50 years from now, and your friends, family, and everyone you know are dead, or 300 years from now? Does it hit different if you're in closer proximity to the moment where they might have been alive for the last time?
Right. I mean, 50 years from now, I would at least have a chance of getting to know Darone as a man.
A boy.
Which would be cool.
Sure. I guess put it a different way, like, does the distance away from their deaths, yeah, like, does that matter in the long term?
It might be cool to get to know Daron as a man, but also, if I've seen one TV show or movie with that premise, I've seen them all, he would be highly resentful of the fact,
yeah,
that I'd gone at this tender age and wouldn't want to get to know
you
me.
You left me.
Yeah, yeah. So,
I don't owe you shit. I'm a Star Wars podcaster.
Michael Bay shot, mm-hmm, spinning around me.
Disappointed!
Captain Valentine lands the space tug in the cargo bay of the Andromeda, and they all put on super duper fly spacesuits ahead of ahead of scouting around in there.
Yeah, the cat lady and Rashi Seamus have really junky looking spacesuits, and Captain Valentine, yeah, has like a better one, and I thought it was interesting that they were kind of mismatched. Like, oh yeah, like these were like the best spacesuits we could afford, but like, you know, some of these we got at like a vintage store and like, you know.
You ever go on the snorkel cruise on vacation and like the crew puts on their gear to like sort of demonstrate how you do it, and their gear is like kicks ass. Like their wetsuit, yeah, looks awesome and it's like super bright neon, and yours is like there's holes in it, yeah, and the printing's all delaminated and stuff. That's what this is.
Yeah. I love Becca Valentine's space helmet. Like bubble space helmet gets me 10 times out of 10. I want to see that in so much more sci-fi.
I like that the Batman doesn't need any of this. He's just got goggles, and you can see his furry arms, yeah, like sticking out into the vacuum.
Yeah, he's fine. And they, yeah, I mean, they don't have the helmets on for that long. Like, they open the door to the Andromeda, and they're like, oh, yeah, it's all right in here. And they just take, yeah, them right back off.
I love how Seamus tells his pals about being in love with the ship, and that's before meeting the AI version of the ship. I feel like I don't need to watch any more of this show to know that that's going to be a thing.
Yeah, Seamus is going to be horny for the Andromeda AI.
Yeah.
They do a thing where they talk about like what beautiful architecture the ship is and how it's a classic, and then they pan around this set and it's, woof, just like, guys, it doesn't work. I'm sorry. I know that this was probably really fucking great for the budget they gave you, but it doesn't fucking work.
It feels like punch-ins on other footage.
Yeah.
Like, it just seemed weird.
Yeah, it's rough. And they're not detecting any life signs, but they're going to start, you know, figuring the
but
ship out.
But they've been detected.
Yeah, and we cut back up to the bridge where Captain Kevin Sorbo is, like, sitting next to the body of Refractions of Dawn, and like,
oh!
Down in the cargo bay, the crew of the Maru are like, did you hear something? No? yeah, and he's like, oh man, like, I gotta check my bank accounts. Like, some of those were interest-bearing. I bet I'm pretty set up right now.
Yeah.
And we should definitely get in touch with the Commonwealth, like talk to them, let them know we're still alive. You know, with any luck, technology's come even further and they can give me an even better new ship with an AI that has even more cleavage. this is as much as the scientists of our era are capable of creating.
I have to phone Geneva right away about my accounts.
They might even have a version D by this point. I think you need this scene for Captain Kevin Sorbo because he's kind of a dope in scenes before this, up until that fight scene, and then he just seems like an action movie bro.
Yeah.
But like, this is the first scene you get of him where he's like introspective and philosophical. Like, if you don't have this scene, he's still the guy from the beginning, which is sort of like a swashbuckler.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to be a deep and weird thing for him to grapple with. One Wolfpimp is very impatient to get this ship delivered to his buyer, who we've heard described as kind of like a teapot dictator, somebody on some planet that's going to use it for bad shit.
Which, did you think they were only talking about the bomb?
I don't know. Like, or is this ship just like better than the ships that are available in this era of galactic history?
Yeah.
So yeah, Captain Becca is like, you got to like slow your roll, man. Like these kind of things take time and we got to like figure out how this ship works. The computer is like advanced in a weird way that we don't get. So we're going to start exploring and like getting things figured out. And she finds the dead body of the dude from the Starboard Defense Station 5 or whatever that died in the battle. And like, he's got to still be warm, right? Like, not that much time has passed from the perspective of this ship.
That's a great call.
So that's got to be a weird moment for her. I liked that she didn't like tell anybody necessarily. Like, she's the captain, so she's the only one that like really needs to know about it, I guess.
Yeah, when the crew arrives to the ship, the thinking among all of them is that everyone's dead, and not just dead, like atomized by the gravitational forces of the black hole. Finding a dead has got to be a real shock.
And like a dead who's like basically intact.
Yeah. Like, may still be brain alive at this point.
Right. The wolf pimp goes down to a bay and finds like giant battle mechs in a hangar. Very badly rendered. Like no bump map on these mechs. Like four polygons max per mech. And the cat lady finds like the arboretum. And it's like, that's also just like a very weird effects shot.
When the lights come on in the like head mask of the mech, you need that blaster beam sound, don't you?
Yeah.
Like you need that blow. You get nothing there. What are you doing?
Yeah. So we had a little text exchange before we started this watch through of this pilot, because I saw in a couple of places this episode being listed as part one, and I don't know what happens in part two, or if that is accurate or not.
Every episode two is a part two to an episode one.
Right. But also, like, you know, when I was reading about the series and it was like, oh, this is a very serialized series in the first season. I mean, like, television now, like, it is not unusual to end the pilot episode on a cliffhanger. But this was weird. Mm-hmm. You know, if this was considered just the pilot and then, like, the next episode isn't a part two, that is like a pretty unusual way of doing it for the era that this was released in. But yeah, like that battle mech like seems to be planting something that does not pay off at all.
No. Yeah. Other than the idea that it is another way for the AI computer to eavesdrop or surveil what's going on in other parts of the ship.
Yeah. And speaking of surveillance, Kevin Sorbo is looking at footage of all these people on his ship. We learn that the Batman is a Magog, who are the horrible psychopaths that the Commonwealth just made this treaty with at the beginning of the episode, causing the Nietzscheans to turn on their former allies.
Do you think their fighting style is Krav Magog?
Quit going for my groin!
Probably.
Yeah, chances are pretty good that that's how they do it. Yeah, and he's like, man, like, what are humans doing working with that guy? Yeah. And it also gives some, like, interesting texture to what the Batman was saying about what he wanted to do with his money. It seems like the Magog have really changed, man.
Maybe. For some people.
Yeah, some of them. We also learned that the wolf pimp is a species called a nightsider. And I read on the Wikipedia article that nightsiders are a rat-like species whose reproduction is very detrimental to the environment of planets that they're on.
So they're fuck musk?
Yeah.
Like burns up the ozone layer?
Yeah, or they have like zillions of kids like rats and it like consumes all the resources. I don't know. It didn't specify.
Yours makes way more sense than mine. Let's go with yours. Captain Kevin Sorbo, like, does the peeping, and he's like, you know, look at me. I'm an absolute unit. Like, I may be outnumbered, but I'm not outnumbered bad. I'm going to go introduce myself.
Yeah.
So he meets rash guy Seamus first. And I wonder how much thought they put into which of these crew people was going to be the one to break it to Captain Kevin Sorbo, like the bad news about the Commonwealth and all that.
Yeah.
That to him, I think, is interesting.
Yeah, like the Commonwealth is no more. It hasn't been around for 300 years, and you guys lost to the Nietzscheans. And more bad news for Captain Kevin Sorbo, basically. So he, like, leaves this guy and goes back up to the bridge, and Rashi Seamus runs back to his friends to describe Captain Kevin Sorbo as being, like, a Greek god, which is, like, a fun bit based on the show that he had just come off of. But also he's like, that guy is fucking huge! And, man, I just didn't get that vibe from him.
I didn't either.
He's never on screen with somebody where I'm like, man, he's like jacked and he towers over everyone else.
It seems like they could have stuffed his leather uniform too if they like really wanted to make him look enormous.
Because that quote at the beginning about the commanders from the High Guard mm-hmm. being like too mm-hmm. brave and too dedicated to their, you know, to whatever. I wouldn't mind it if he looked like a little like cartoonishly huge. But like,
sure.
I mean, it kind of hits the same way as like, oh my God, look at the beautiful architecture of this ship. Pan to like shitty, you know, styrofoam set detail, you know.
That's funny that it's sort of baked into the language of the script, like you're saying.
Yeah.
Like to be in awe of things is in all of the dialogue everywhere. And so you're sort of hypnotized.
Like, if Dwayne Johnson had been cast as Captain Michael Hunt,
mm-hmm.
we might be having a different conversation right now.
Might be. Yeah. Captain Kevin Sorbo can't quite wrap his mind around the idea of the Commonwealth being gone because, as he describes it, the Commonwealth is so huge. It encompasses so many planets and ships and people and stuff. He's like, there's got to be someone out there from the Commonwealth that we can hook up with. And this seems to be, like, his mission starting now.
Yeah. And, man, did you get, like, post-season 3 Discovery vibes from that?
Yeah.
We've gone into the future and found the civilization that we closely identify with in shambles. It's time to, like, start putting it back together.
And I'm the only one who can do it.
Yeah.
I will be outnumbered utterly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting comparison.
So he gets on the 1MC and threatens the salvager crew. Like, if you don't get off my ship, I'm going to start coming and killing you. And the wolf pimp is like, all right, like, time to get serious about murdering this guy so we can steal his ship. And he like dramatically reveals his Nietzschean kill squad that he has brought with him to the salvager crew.
These guys look like absolute badasses.
They really do. I am not wildly optimistic that Wolf Pimp intends to pay Becca Valentine and her crew, given the presence of these dudes.
I think he's already pre-blown all his money on his prince blouses. Did you like this episode, Ben?
She'll always bring it home.
Man, I gotta say, it's an interesting pilot. I definitely never watched this show.
Same.
And when I saw it, like, this was a show where, like, I would occasionally flip past it on, like, very late in my, I think, like, basically high school was when we had cable at my house for the first time. And it was, I think, on sometimes on cable, and I was never curious about checking it out.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Like, all respect to Gene Roddenberry, the creator of some of our favorite television shows. Did you reject latter Roddenberry series just out of hand the way I did? Because when I saw his name on some of these properties, I was like, nope, that's not for me. Even though I respect that guy's game. I love a lot of his work. But, like, the stuff of this era is stuff I was not really willing to give a chance.
Yeah, I think that was part of it for me. Like, if it's not trying to be Star Trek, I'm not really that interested. And it's like, it's very interesting to me that Discovery is working with such a similar premise.
Yeah.
In its like back half of seasons to this, because it kind of feels like a Roddenberry idea coming back home to Star Trek. I know that this isn't like the most original premise for a sci-fi thing, but like, honestly, like, feel more curious about the show having seen the pilot than I thought I would. And mm-hmm. I do think it's a hell of a lot better of a pilot than the Earth Final Conflict one.
I mean, yeah, there aren't as many dead wives. Actually, there's probably way more dead wives given the 300 years that have passed.
Yeah.
Really sets a record for dead wives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This pilot.
So yeah, I think this one surprised me. Like, I think that there's some parts of it that are objectively redonkulous and bad. And also, I wouldn't feel right like getting through this whole thing without just saying for the record, I think Kevin Sorbo seems like a horrible person. It definitely like makes me less excited to watch this show because of him being the lead of it. But overall, I thought the pilot was a fun and interesting episode of television. So I would take this one to series. I want to see where they go with this.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to remember how you described the hook of this story as being a little bit recooked. Like the idea of a ship or a crew going out of time.
Yeah.
You know, into the far future. I like stories like that. And one of my favorite moments in Star Trek Discovery was that jump.
Yeah.
Like the moment of it before and after, I thought was really powerful. And I think the show was right to give Captain Kevin Sorbo a moment to absorb that in order to, you know, make him the captain to the viewer that he needs to be to carry the show the way he has to. It's really silly.
Yeah.
Making the ship sexy is like, it's such a dudes writing for dudes idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
that is like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? The way you fix it, though, is to create the idea that there are many of this type of ship and that AI is just a Siri decision based on its captain and everyone gets to make their own AI.
But it's a weird choice to make in front of your crew. Like, I'm going to have the AI.
Yeah. This is what I'm into, guys.
Yeah.
I'm going to really care about this ship a lot.
And then meanwhile, over on the SeaQuest, the AI is like crusty old man.
Yeah. Yeah. What does that say about that, Captain?
Captain Roy Scheider's like, wait, you can do that? Oh!
I'm not the biggest fan of Interstellar, the movie, but I think one thing that movie did really well was lean very hard into how time can hurt. And I hope this is a show that does a little bit more of that, you know, in reaction to the use of a black hole to freeze the time that Captain Kevin Sorbo had.
Yeah.
Like, I hope this isn't the only instance of a singularity being used to advance a story, because that stuff really interests me a lot. I mean, maybe this is just a show about bats and wolf pimps and stuff from here on out, but like, if you really want to mess with someone's feelings, like, take away three generations of people from them.
Right.
And get that fish out of water the way you do here. If that is a consistent bell ring on this show, yeah, take it to series.
Yeah. And get that guy some fucking ointment for that rash.
Yeah.
Should we check the priority one inbox?
I cannot wait.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first priority one message is of a personal nature. It is from your favorite Android ensign. It is to Tyler! Exclamation point. Their message goes like this. Tyler! You're my favorite life form. I'm so glad I found you. What were the odds? Wasn't even scanning. You're the best friend an Android could dream of. You teach me so much. about being human. Let's grab some Rat Gugino next time. We both get shore leave. Can't wait to learn more jokes and practice gossiping about new specimens in the Arboretum.
Oh, what a sweet message.
Just friends toasting friends there.
Yeah, that rules.
Yeah.
Our next Priority One message is from Captain Dakota, and it's to anybody who wants a cocktail. Goes like this. Caught up on pod, throwing traditional celebratory scarves, plus two versions of my cocktail, the Magellan. So this is a cocktail recipe. 1.5 ounces of rum, 1/2 ounce of Disaronno or Orgeat. And I guess Orgeat is like almond syrup. So I guess is Disaronno like almond liqueur?
It is, yeah.
And then 1/2 ounce of Campari and 1/4 ounce of fresh lime juice. Shake and strain into a Collins glass. First voyage, top with seltzer and stir gently. Second voyage, top with light pineapple juice and stir well. Anybody?
I really like that combination of sweet and almond and bitter and sour.
Yeah.
The balance of this seems pretty delicious.
Yeah, I would definitely give this a try. And, you know, that second voyage, going to make the ropes better. So, you know, every little bit helps.
Always have to consider the ropes, I think, when you're mixing a cocktail.
Well, thank you for sending that in, Captain Dakota. There's a note here that says the name references an earlier P1 spelling mistake, intentional this time. That's a very Greatest Gen way to be.
Love it.
Thanks to everybody who got a P1. If you'd like to get a message on the show, it's really easy to do. You just head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron and sign up for one. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And it's a great way to support what we do.
It's time to get your messages in for the next season of Star Trek Discovery.
Good point.
Get him in there.
Yeah, we won't have P1s on the show for the next 2 weeks, but after that they will be back and will be new episodes of Discovery, so get them in.
Hey Ben,
what's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself an Edward Larkin in this pilot season episode?
Edward Larkin. I'm gonna give it to Tuskman Blue Man, voiced by Rolf in the opening combat sequence. I kind of felt like this a little bit with Batman. Just like the choice made there, and we've talked about this a lot, like when you make an acting choice like that and your show goes to series, you're stuck with it. And this pilot had two different aliens that were like, oh, I'm a weird alien guy. And I mean, also the loaf on that blue guy was just brutal. and they like keep cutting to him for react shots as like,
yeah,
as things are going on around him. And I was just like, man, how did this guy even find his way onto this human ass ship? This like ignominious role, only to then have a voice done by Rolf.
Pretty great.
How about you? Did you find yourself an Edward Larkin?
Mine feels a little bit weird, but I think you're gonna find yourself on the level. Just the someone in that room, someone came up with the concept with a straight face. Ship with boobs. How do we do it? Let's really figure this out.
Yeah.
Like someone.
We didn't even talk about all the androids that are walking around that all have boobs also.
Yeah. Every android has boobs on this show.
Yeah.
I want to know more about the boobs person in the writer's room. I want to know about a writer's room environment that made that for some reason not immediately shot down as an idea. Was this just a beers after work kind of idea? Like, I know we said we wouldn't talk about work, but I got an idea. Let's hang them out. The ship, I mean. Wouldn't that be cool? Like, I wonder if there's a season of this show where they put the uniform on Deanna Troi here.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Where a Ronnie Cox comes in and goes, no, the AI deserves some uniform respect. It certainly didn't start in the pilot. So, yeah, just what a swing.
Yeah.
That it was pitched, that it was hit, that it was made. That's the idea. That is my Edward Larkin.
Oh, man.
Incredible.
Lexia Doig, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, the actor who played Andromeda Ascendance AI, also had an 11-episode character on Stargate SG-1 and was on Earth Final Conflict for an episode.
Cool.
And she's still working.
Like that.
She has 2023 credits.
That rules. I like that her nickname later in the show is Rami.
Oh, interesting.
Like short for Andromeda.
That's cute.
That works. Yeah. That's an opportunity for a nickname that Refractions of Dawn never got.
Yeah. RSVP Refractions of Dawn.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we're going to talk about next week's episode of Pilot Season in a bit. But Adam, why don't you bless the people with a warning bois?
Prepare a buoy and launch it when ready.
Warning buoys.
An emergency buoy.
A warning buoy.
Warning buoys are a great way to get the word out about our show, and that's why we share them, to encourage more of this behavior. Ben, our warning bois today comes from Apple Podcasts. It's a 5-star review. The most helpful kind.
It really is.
Headline is, you guys get paid for this? Review goes like this. I measure my weeks by the episodes these silly guys make. What an amazing gift it is to listen to these silly jokes and to learn film and TV terms and critique along the way. That's really it, isn't it? That's the whole enchilada.
That is really nice. Thank you for leaving that review.
It's from Gorth Gorndacker. That sounds like a name that would go great on a show like Andromeda.
It does, yeah. Yeah, leaving a review is one of those ways to support that doesn't cost you anything and really juices our position in the algo, and we really appreciate it. So if you have anything kind to say about this show, drop a 5-star review on us, and you might hear us saying it out loud here in the Warning Bois segment.
Yeah.
Okay, Adam.
What are we going to watch next on Pilot Season, Ben? How is it going to get any better than this?
We've gotten this request a lot, Adam, and we're finally going to do it. We're going to split this up over 2 weeks because this is a two-part mini-series.
Okay.
We are going to be reviewing the first part of the 2003 Battlestar Galactica mini-series.
Whoa.
Which was, a pilot for a series that they made a lot of episodes of and a lot of people really love, you know, and stars like, it's got quite the cast. Edward James Olmos, Mary McDonnell.
How many episodes are we talking about then?
So it's just 2 episodes, but I think each one is 90 minutes. So it's
I get it.
It's like a 3-hour movie told in 2 parts, essentially. I see. Following the destruction of the 12 colonies of Kobol by Cylons, a ragtag fugitive fleet of the last remnants of mankind flees the pursuing Cylons while simultaneously searching for their true home, Earth.
Ben, I really love this show.
Oh, interesting.
I love this movie. I love the movies that came from this, the multiple series there have been. I think this is some real best-in-class science fiction here that I really enjoyed. So I hope you do too.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch it. I think I've seen this, but I don't exactly remember whether I saw this or just a lot of episodes of the series. I didn't finish the series, but I'm definitely excited to check this out. So next week is also the first week of the Max Fun Drive, so we will be kicking off the Max Fun Drive with part one of the Battlestar Galactica miniseries and finishing the Max Fun Drive strong with part two, and really hope a lot of folks find it in their hearts to join Booster Upgrade in the drive this year. And, you know, you'll hear lots more about that next week, so I won't belabor that too much, but I'm super pumped for this. And right after that, we're going to be going into Disco Season 5, so get excited, folks.
No, I am.
Thanks to the Friends of DeSoto for listening to Pilot Season. We out.
Greatest Trek is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica. It's produced by Wendy Pretty, and this episode was edited by Allie Love. Next week on Pilot Season, it's part one of the Battlestar Galactica miniseries, and the USS Hood Discord server is still hosting a handful of weekly watch parties for those pilots, so head on over to join at drunkshimoda.com. Thanks to Adam Ragusea, who composed the theme music for Greatest Trek. You can find his YouTube cooking channel and podcast by searching for Adam Ragusea. Thanks to Nick Dickmore for creating the show art, and thanks to Bill Tilly for managing all of the Greatest Trek social media pages. Make sure you find and follow those pages and use hashtag Greatest Trek when you post about the show. And thank you to the Max Fun members who contribute directly each month. The drive starts next week, and members are going to get a couple of new bonus episodes from Ben and Adam. Plus, there's an amazing back catalog of bonus content to enjoy as well. Set up your membership at MaximumFun.org/join. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Greatest Trek.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.